Let's recall where we are and remember where we are. We're talking about seeing the mind objectively with a sense of deeper understanding. If we stopped there, our whole sense of what is real would be infused with paradox. And eventually the sharpness of seeing the mind from a sense of overall understanding decays. It actually decays because we don't maintain that sharp accuracy. It decays into a sense of infinite regressions, a sense that paradox and puzzlement are the rule of life, are what is real. So like in the source of in the Upanishadic tradition of disclosing this was in the Katha Upanishad, and the same wisdom tradition discloses it in Plato's myth of the chariot in his dialogue. I believe it's in the Republic. There is a shape to the understanding, and the shape to the understanding is what in the Katha Upanishad is called the Great Self, or what we might today call the Self, the Deep Self, is the shape of understanding. When understanding itself is shape, when the authenticity of the existential presence is shaped, that's the Deep Self. That's the God within, says Socrates. And to worship any other expression is a form of idolatry. But that God within is of such a nature that is not limited to us. We partake of it, participate, but is not limited to us in any way whatsoever, and yet has a shape, which is us. So there's always that kind of an uncanny sense that ignorance comes from taking the ecology of realization only so far and stopping. That ignorance comes from not following it through all the way to its completion. And that knowing, or wisdom, is following it all the way through to its completion. So that the wisdom tradition of mankind is to alert us to the fact, do not make, in your own judgment, some final end or some final purpose. Don't you put a name on God. Don't you have some kind of idea. That sure as shooting, any of those names, any of those ideas are going to be resolutions before the whole process is finished, before one has actually achieved the whole journey. You'll mistake some stage which has all the qualities of being a final purpose. They always do. You always think, oh, that's it. That sweet certainty is always there, and then it transforms and you're off again. So it's a quality that's best handled, the wisdom traditions tell us, by keeping alive a sense of mystery within ourselves, a sense of unknowing, a sense that, well, you don't really know. What you are you're convinced that you know, hold that in a suspension of possibility. Not of maybe, not of skepticism, but a sense of openness. The classic term would be translated into modern English as openness. So that, like in the Katha Upanishad, it said that the Great Self occurs in its definiteness in the unmanifest. And the unmanifest has a feminine gender to it in Sanskrit. The unmanifest is the great mother. The shape of the great self is born out of the divine mother, who is unmanifest. And the Kathaya Upanishad says that what is behind the unmanifest, what allows the unmanifest to occur, that is God. And not to be overly concerned then with any kind of pet theories or pet projections, because they're almost certain to flake off someplace in this transformative process. And if you've identified with them, if you said, that's me, then you're going to have the sense that you're flaking off. Let all those flakes burn off. What you really are is not capable of being flaked. You're not perishable. What is perishable is only an appearance which is conditionally assumed temporarily, however gorgeous it is. And it's not like not to worry about the problem, but the deeper insight. It's like a French psychiatrist, Hubert Benoit, said, the realization is not the answer to the problem, but the deeper realization that there never was a problem in the first place. Let's take a break and we'll come back. Let me just see, how many have a copy of Alchemical Studies? How many were able to get a copy of Alchemical Studies? Most of you? Almost everybody has a copy of Alchemical Studies. Does your paper-bound edition, does it have the frontispiece that the hardcover has? Should have. Hope it does. Yeah. If you, when you go to make your next reading in it, at 6:45 this evening, or some such time, take a look at the frontispiece. The frontispiece is a very accurate, symbolic presentation. This creature does not occur in nature. This creature does not occur objectively. This alchemical creature has all of the stages, but all of the stages have become phases, so they're able to be presented together. So this is a symbolic image of all of the phases of the transformation together as one ecology. So this is a creature of the process. So that's what it is. And if you notice, down in the lower right-hand corner is written Python. Python. Python is the great serpent. It's a continuous, eternal image that comes up in the deep realization of this process. Like 5,000 years ago, in the earliest forms of consistent religious writing, some 3,000 BC, in the earliest of the Egyptian manuscripts, you have Apophis, you have the great serpent, whose sinuous body has a very peculiar characteristic to it. We do not understand anymore, unless you own a pet snake, that no matter how many joints the snake has, when the snake exercises its life function, it does it as a single muscle. Have you ever seen a constricting snake kill something? Like that. Doesn't, like in the movies, wrap itself slowly around and slowly strangle it. It grabs the prey with the whole body and as quick as the eye could see, kills it. Because the whole snake is one muscle. This process, if you are unable to follow it through to its completion, is a killer process, because it is complete, and if you aren't complete and with it, you will die. Death is inevitable. That's the peril of the esoteric python. But if you follow the process of realization all the way through, you will not die. You are the whole of the process. The process will not kill you. So there is that kind of deep religious insight. And I might point out to you that it's there before any of the contemporary world religions are born. It was ancient 5,000 years ago. It's not a particularly Egyptian realization that came into Egypt from elsewhere. So this is worth contemplating. Now, the Alchemical Studies has five different books in it, five different treatises, and we've portioned them out to various people. Let me read off what we have. And we're going to start next week with The Secret of the Golden Flower, Sina, Robert, and Dolores. Well, then the person who can be synchronistically is going to have a lot of responsibility and better consult with the others sometime before. Who can be here?
I can.
Is that why you spoke up and not they?
Well, I think they should have the opportunity to make their own presentation. Can we do any shifting? They each have commitments.
I guess you're all just going to miss it. Right. I have to continue, and I have to work the way that we're working. And I do my best to be sinuous, but I can't ignore the situation. If I tailor the situation to everybody's exigencies, we would have a crazy quilt. So we'll just do the best that we can. Did I tell you that I used to use, years ago, in the early 1970s, 70, 71, 72, I used to use the Book of Hopi in this kind of a way, and only once in 5 years did the process work. Once in 5 years. It's because we do not live in any kind of continuity anymore that allows for the teaching of wisdom in its correct form. So we just do the best that we can. So we have the Golden Flower. The second, the Vision of Zosimos. That's Carol and Jerry and Donna. And you people are aware of that? Have been, I guess, for a couple of months?
That won't be next week.
Well, if we don't have many for the Secret of the Golden Flower, maybe we'll get to the Vision of Zosimos also. You're not, none of you are able to be here next week either?
I won't be able to be here next week. That day's been deleted from the calendar.
And then third is Paracelsus. Now that was Dan and Molly. And because they were not here, Gustavo and Sylvie. And then four, the Spiritus Mercurius, Linda, who has been here once in 3 months, and Don and Lois. So. And then the philosophical tree, it's Chris and Ed and Jennifer, who hasn't been here for a month now, and Walter and Toshi. So we do the best that we can. And next week we'll come to these, and we'll start with the beginning. What I would like to do is go through the alchemical process in 2 weeks. That's what I'd like to do, on the basis of these presentations. Why is it important for you to do the presentations? Why can't I do the presentations? Because my part at this juncture of conscientiousness is to be able to back off and let you take over. If I don't make a point of that, you will not understand that that's essential. It's essential for you to know that you don't need me at this particular juncture, that you can do it. What can you do? You can make this educational process work. Now, it's important at the end of the magic section that we emphasize that, because when it comes to the final section at the end of this year, I'm going to disappear as much as I can. Oh, I'll be here. And I'll talk. But in the science, you'll be carrying the whole sequence of whatever happens. It's important for you to have that kind of liberty. And that kind of liberty requires, as the old saying is, fraternity. You can do it together, for each other. And equality. Everyone's important. I must say that I see each of you as important as myself in this process. And it isn't just a Jeffersonian kind of an ideal that I have. It's the truth of the matter. I see that quite clearly. I understand that quite clearly. What each of you are able to do in your own lives is as important as what I can do in my own life, because we don't know where all these roots go to, but we have to understand that is true. That is a true process. So we have this coming up next week. If anybody will be here, you can always send someone in your place. You can always send a friend to represent yourself. If I could, I would, but I don't think we'll have time to do all five. I think it'll take 2 weeks. Minimal 2 weeks. Send emissaries. Send friends of yours. Send neighbors to be in your stead. I mean, can I speak frankly? In an ancient wisdom school, you would never be absent. Where are you going to go from the process of discovery that isn't already an error? Oh, but I have to change my life. Well, that's right, isn't it? That's the way it used to be taught. That's why it was always excerpted from the pell-mell atmosphere of this world. But you see, there are no retreats left. There are no places that we can go to except those silences that we make together whenever and wherever we can camp. I mean, this situation here is only available because I've defended it. You don't see the dueling scars, but there are lots of scars. Lots of mileage on this particular person here. And this occurs just because it's been defended and been made. Chapter 2 of The Art of Memory, and if you would look on with each other, you can make copies for yourself if you don't have one, with these emendations after the lecture. I want to just go over these emendations so you can have some recourse when you read it. Frances Yates is very good, but she's still an academic. And though she's extremely accurate, her limitations are not ours. We don't have to accept her limitations. You're in a situation where the perspective is able to be considerably broader, that's all. On page 28, the theory, later succinctly summed up by Horace in his famous phrase, ut pictura poesis. And Plutarch called painting silent poetry, and called poetry painting that speaks. For the actions which painters depict as they are being performed, words described after they are done. There is a sense of poetry and painting together, going down the page, that there is a supremacy of the visual sense. And I emphasize here that this is a Greek Hellenistic bias, that there are some cultures where the ear is more perfect than the eye. And there are even some cultures where there's a sense of taste, which is more profound than one, than the eye or the ear. There are cultures like the African, where it's the gestalt of movement that is important, and not the eye and not the ear, but what one feels in the dance. The pacing of the dance, the rhythms of the movement are what are important. So there are many different ways of looking at this. The elusive relationship with other arts runs all through the history of the art of memory. Then over onto the other page, page 29, that this art of memory, which she is discussing, in the Greek tradition, probably derived from an earlier oral tradition. And this is most certainly true. Some think that it was Pythagorean. Others have hinted at Egyptian influence. There's no need to hint. It was Egyptian core. For the Greek experience, the subconscious of Greece was Egypt. Just like we have in our subconscious, it's called Judeo-Christian, but what it is a very complex Hellenism as our subconscious. For the Greeks, they had an Egyptian subconscious. The Greeks were so accurate because of an Egyptian subconscious that they were able to free up their consciousness and think outside the lines. Without the Egyptian subconscious, it would hardly have been possible to have a freed consciousness. And yet, whenever you find the Greek tone of civilization or culture, its archetypal quality is of perfect symmetry. The ultimate symbol of the Greek archetypal subconscious was Zeus. And Zeus is always portrayed. I think the statue would have been of the arm out and the other arm cocked back to throw the thunderbolt. But it's a symmetry of perfect balance in the Greek archetypal mind, being Egyptian, had its formalized, rigid, categorical implicitness so that the complement to it could be a free, facile kind of consciousness. And that characterizes the Greek. So this thing about hinted at Egyptian influence is most certainly the case. The earliest written form of Greek was not Linear B, but Linear A, from about 2000 BC. And at that time, Linear A is very much in the cognate languages, the family of languages that would have been spoken throughout the Fertile Crescent, including Egypt. If you get interested, the great figure who dominated the last node, the last archetypal node for that time period that became the subconscious for classical Greece was Sargon of Akkad. And we still, almost miraculously, have a gold life mask of Sargon of Akkad. I can show it to you. I have a photograph of it here, and you can see Sargon has Semitic features, but they're arranged in what turns out later to be a classical Greek mode. It's a very, very interesting thing. But where the classical Greek Apollo face is perfectly symmetrical, perfectly balanced, it does not have the living personality in it. It's like a perfect expression of what the archetype is from a neutral interior, objective self. So that when you hold, an Apollo, say like the Apollo Belvedere, and you hold the face of the Apollo Belvedere next to Sargon of Akkad, you can see that the structure is exactly the same, except that Sargon is there. It's his face, whereas the Apollo of Belvedere is an archetypal face. And there's that kind of a relationship there. So on page 30, moving over, memory for things, memory for words or names. And notice here that if one is not conscious of this, you can confuse the two. You can confuse the name with the thing. You can confuse language with the objective nature. They are in parallel and they are in sync, but they are not at all the same thing. Later on page 30, going down to the starred paragraph. In this earliest Art of Memory treatise, the images for words are formed from primitive etymological dissection of the word, pictograph. Before the hieroglyph, the pictograph. In the examples given of images for things, the things virtue and vice are represented, valor, cowardice, also an art, metallurgy. They are deposited in memory with images of gods and men. Here we may perhaps see, in an archaically simple form, those human figures representing things, which eventually developed into the agent images. Notice how the objectivizing of the senses objectifies it in such a way that as it becomes objectivized, it also occurs in the mind at the same time. As you are able to see a thing, you are able to see the thing in the mind also. So as the world becomes objectified, as the senses become able to focus on the thing, on the object, the mind has an image of that object at the same time. They occur, the word is concomitantly. They occur concomitantly. I like to use this kind of a word in connection with it because it is true of psychic energy. The image in the mind and the thing are a resonance of each other. They have a correspondence, and the correspondence is not of an echo. The mind is not a delayed reaction echo, but it occurs along with the objectivizing of the thing in the world, so that there's an interpenetration. There are resonances. Let me give you just a little hint here. Adam becomes the first man because he can name things, can name creatures. His personal capacity as a person occurs at the same time that to the extent that he's able to name what things are. So he achieves a kind of a mental consciousness. He achieves a mind as a person by exercising that faculty, that capacity. They occur together. It's very important to understand. They occur together. So that, notice, an image in the mind is not so much a representation of a thing outside, but in technical language would be a co-presentation of it. The image in the mind forms in resonance to the image of the world. This is an extremely powerful realization. One of the great principles of modern science, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, grabs itself all around this kind of a quandary and failure to understand accurately. That objective observation on a nuclear level of process is interfered with by the observer. So much so that one has to take the observer into account all the time. Now, the corollary that Niels Bohr understood, and Heisenberg didn't quite really ever believe, he understood it but never believed it, but Niels Bohr understood it, is not only does the observer interfere on that level, but that the objective reality is correspondent with the observer. And of course there's a great deal of 21st century science that will come out of exploring that whole capacity. There'll be such a thing as psychic nuclear physics, I guarantee you. There is already in the advanced states of physics today. There are certain words that are used, strangeness, beauty, as characterizing objective reality, and they are words from Kabbalistic understanding of psychic energy, because it happens to be as accurate a statement as human beings are capable of making. So there are flavors to objective gestalts which are clearly a mental or supposedly mind orientations. So they occur together. And so this little phrase here on page 30 is interesting. Over on 31, Aristotle was certainly familiar with the artificial memory, which he refers to four times. Now, if you think that the images in the mind are representations of the exterior world, then you think that this art of memory is the art, is artificial memory. And Aristotle, in his published treatises, was always concerned to express it in that way. So that, for instance, the classical art of mimetic is derived from Aristotle's writings. The arrangement of the mind is a mimesis of the arrangement of things. So that the mind is a representation of nature. But it only takes a moment of reflection about this to understand that this is indeed has an arcane aspect to it in Aristotle. Aristotle's word, the Greek word for nature, is not thing, it's physis. Physics today, we call it. Physis means emerging. It's a process. It's an ongoing process. So it's not as if physical nature were a static thing which the mind mirrors, so that the image is then a static representation of some static thing. It's not objective in that sense at all. Nature is constantly occurring. The mind, with its imagery, is constantly occurring. They occur together. They always occur together. You know, Aristotle studied with Plato for 20 years. The only reason he left was that Plato died. Now, you can find it in Plato very accurately in the Timaeus and the Theaetetus. Plato's theory of knowledge is disclosed in the Theaetetus, and the cosmological implications are in the dialogue of the Timaeus. But there is a very real presentation of the mysterious hermetic quandary, mind and reality, in a dialogue called the Parmenides. And the Parmenides, Plato takes up the old pre-Socratic Parmenides, the ultimate quandary, the ultimate ideational presentation of the quandary. What is, and what isn't, isn't. And that's a polarity that will break all mental ideational approaches. It's like a Zen koan. What is, and what isn't, isn't. It's a mutually exclusive polarity which throws the mind in any process mode that it takes into an analogy configuration. I'm using highfalutin language here. Polarity and analogy go together. They always occur together. Wherever you have that kind of polarity, and the more you insist on a polarity, even to its ultimate mutually exclusive definition, the more the mind is thrown into an analog process. Analog to what? An analog to its real occurrence. So ideation based on an analog mode of operation, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, becomes a representation. It becomes a mimetic process. And if you believe that that is true with a capital T, then all of this will seemingly be artificial. Now there's a psychotherapeutic core here of peril, because if you really do believe that your mental processes are artificial, then you have a distinct angst in you. Well, what the hell is not artificial then? What is authentic? And because you don't know, and because you have no way mentally of knowing a priori, you've set yourself up as an indefinite patsy of your own fears. It's not that you don't know yourself, it's that you understand that you can never know yourself. Well, that is a cause for anxiety. And if you believe that, you better stock up on the pills. Because if you really do believe, that's relief is the only thing that you can have. There's no resolution to that at all. That's thinking in a Zen way that there is a problem. So she introduces here that one of the references in Aristotle to the art of memory, and even though she is calling it here artificial memory, we have to put an asterisk by that, one of these references is in the Topics. Aristotle's treatise, the Topics, topoi in Greek. Notice that a topic in our language, in English, is cognate with a subject. The topic that you talk about, the it is in Greek too. The topoi in Greek are places, but the places are the places in the mind. So that the subjective is the mind's correspondence to the topics or the subjects that are out there. So the topoi of the places out there are correspondent to the topoi of the places in the mind. So if one arranges the places in the mind, one can arrange the places in the world on that basis. It's secular to understand that there is a time delay there, that one envisions a plan in the mind and then one carries one's plan out in the world. That's a secular understanding of that. The magical understanding, which is religious, is that that happens instantaneously. As soon as you arrange it in the mind, it is arranged in the world. And that it's just the slowness of the world to respond to the new arrangement that seemingly takes time. Now, because this was forbidden as a human capacity by empire structuring of religious experience, it was said that, well, this only happens for God's mind. When God thinks thoughts, that's the way the world is. And then eventually it came to be understood in that, well, the world must be the thoughts of God. That's what it must be. All of this goes back to this kind of confusion that happens here in the 4th century B.C. The confusion by not understanding that the images in the mind are correspondent with the things in nature. They are correspondent. They are resonant together. They occur together. They never, in reality, occur separately. So that it's not so much that images arise in the mind, but that the images are there in the mind all the time and one just has consciousness of them. They're discovered rather than made. So that the true esoteric quality about the mind, it always records exactly and accurately in an image correspondence the world.